It's Tuesday, March 4, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We are now experiencing, in the United States and in Western civilization, a vast moral revolution. We know it, we feel it, we can trace it. The issues involved in this moral revolution involve issues such as homosexuality and same-sex marriage, the legalization of marijuana, but it also relates to how we even understand ourselves as human beings, to issues related to our judicial system, to everything that is related to the entire code of morality, to practical questions such as what is a family and how do we raise our children. But it's on the issue of homosexuality that the moral shift has taken place in the most traceable and documentable way at a velocity we've never seen before. The latest evidence comes in a poll that has been produced by the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute. According to this poll, the support for allowing same-sex marriage, allowing the legalization of same-sex relationships, and normalizing homosexuality, well, now 53% of the sample of 4,509 Americans said that they support same-sex marriage. That's up from 32% in 2003. In other words, in 2003, only 32% of Americans said they favor the legalization of same-sex marriage. Now it's 53%. It's not only a growth of 20% in just about 10 years, it's also a growth from being just one out of three Americans to more than half. In other words, the moral shift that has taken place is now so vast that the growth in the 20% is likely to dim over against the growth from 53 to a far higher percentage in very short order. That's because of the way moral revolutions work. Moral revolutions work like other major social movements. You try to start something, and it starts very slowly. It begins to gain momentum. But once a critical mass is reached, and 53% of the population is by any estimation a critical mass, then the momentum begins not to slow, but to build. That's why, for instance, we've had 11 state and federal judiciary decisions on the issue of same-sex marriage just since June of last year. That's why, in short order, 7 states found themselves looking at declarations of the legalization of same-sex marriage in the process of about 6 months. That's why we're looking at a change in the culture in terms of advertising, in terms of public symbols, in terms of entertainment, that shows that the gap is now closing, that the window for the traditional understanding of marriage is now closing in the society. And those who hold to a biblical understanding of sexual morality now find themselves, ourselves, existing as a cognitive and a moral minority in a larger culture that is decidedly heading in a different direction. Quoting directly from the executive summary of this report, quote, "It is difficult to overstate the effect age has on support for same-sex marriage, which is evident even among groups that oppose same-sex marriage." Listen carefully. "Half of millennial Republicans favor allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry, a view shared by only 18% of Republicans who are members of the silent generation." That's approximately 45 and up. Now, that statement alone, "It's difficult to overstate the effect age has on support for same-sex marriage," tells us something. That's something else we need to know when we think about a moral revolution. It's not evenly distributed geographically. It's also not evenly distributed generationally. But if you are trying to foment a revolution, trying to promote a revolution, you don't aim at the old, you aim at the young. Because if you have the young, by definition, you have the future. And that was a very smart tactical move on the part of those pushing for the legalization of same-sex marriage. Also citing from the report directly, quote, "Millennials report a nearly 20-point gap between the views of their families and the views of their friends. Nearly half of millennials say most of their family members oppose same-sex marriage, compared to 41% who say most of their family members support it. In contrast, only 30% of millennials say most of their friends oppose same-sex marriage, while nearly twice as many, that's 59%, say most of their friends favor same-sex marriage," end quote. So when you consider the shift in this moral revolution, consider what this tells us about the change in the field of reference. If the field of reference is the family of origin, support for same-sex marriage is decidedly running against it. But if the field of reference is a peer culture, as it is for adolescents and for young adults, that peer culture dominates in the opposite direction, indicating that support for same-sex marriage is entirely predictable if you know not so much the geographic location, but the generational identification of the person who's going to be asked the question. Thinking about this through the lens of the Christian worldview, there is much for us to consider, but a part of it is the necessity of making compelling arguments where many people think the argument has been lost. That's one of our responsibilities in this particular moral emergency. We may lose the argument in the culture, but we're in grave danger if we lose the argument with our own kids. At the very least, we need to make the argument in the best way we know possible, making very clear how it is rooted in biblical authority. And more than that, pointing out that what the Bible reveals is what God has given to us that will aid and make possible human flourishing. In other words, what we have to give ourselves and our own children is the understanding that when people demand same-sex marriage and they think that having it will lead to human happiness, the reality is that if Scripture is true, it will not lead to human happiness. And it is not the act of a friend to give people what they demand when we know that it will lead to their harm rather than to their good. Next, staying on the issue of happiness but shifting to the topic of hell, a couple of researchers are arguing that the nations that have people who are more likely to believe in hell are actually less likely to be happy. The academic journal is PLOS ONE. The professors were Azim Sharif of the University of Oregon and Laura Acknon of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. They were looking at countries in which people believed in heaven, people believed in hell, and people believed in both. But the bottom line in the research has to do with those nations that had people who generally believed in hell. And according to these researchers, those people are not as happy as those in countries that do not believe in hell. Reading from the article, quote, looking at survey data from 63 countries, the researchers found that the more a belief in heaven outstripped a belief in hell in a country, the happier and more satisfied the residents were. When researchers looked at individual responses, they found a similar pattern. People who believe in heaven reported greater satisfaction with life. The survey data came from the Gallup World Poll, the World Value Survey, and the European Value Survey. Of the 63 nations surveyed, Christianity or Islam dominated in all but 8. However, an analysis of individual responses found no meaningful difference in this pattern of belief and life satisfaction between members of Abrahamic religions, that's what this journal calls Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and those of non-Abrahamic religions. I'll simply let the researchers define it that way for this purpose, but the bottom line is the issue is hell, and the argument of these researchers is that if you believe in hell, you're likely both individually and gathered together in nations to be less happy than if you merely believe in heaven. It's a really interesting article. It has to do with psychology, demographics, ideology, and a whole lot more, but what it really points to is the eclipse of hell. There are all kinds of issues at stake here. There are political issues, ideological issues, there are psychological issues, sociological issues, but the most essential issue we know is theological. In other words, it really doesn't matter if the belief in hell makes you happy or makes you sad. The question is hell real? And that's the very question that isn't even considered in this report. My first response when I was contacted about this research was to point out that it might not make you happy to understand that hell exists, but then again, hell is not a happy place. It is not a happy thing that hell exists, regardless of whether you believe in it or not. The reality is, however, there is a hell, and yet that is a reality that has been denied by more and more people, especially in the post-secular West, and that is increasingly true for people who just lose confidence that what is taught in the Bible is true. Hell is eclipsed for many years now. The first issue is a changed view of God. The biblical vision of God has been rejected by the culture as too restrictive of human freedom, offensive to human sensibilities. God's love has been redefined in so many people, including in so many churches, so that human autonomy is undisturbed. Far too many people in the world today, including many who consider themselves Christians, have an understanding of divine love that's never coercive and would disallow any thought that God would send impenitent sinners to eternal punishment in the fires of hell. Many people, including liberal theologians, have been trying to rescue God and rescue Christianity from having a bad reputation associated with hell. But the reality is, as even someone like C.S. Lewis noted so well, what you have in terms of the promise of heaven makes no sense without the threat of hell. And the threat of hell is very real. Let's remember that Jesus said very clearly, "Fear not the one who can destroy the body, but fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell." The New Testament, even the gospel itself, is incomprehensible without the understanding that hell is a very real place, and it is indeed the final place of judgment, the final place of God's justice. It is an embodied existence, a conscious existence, which is revealed very clearly within Scripture. The theologian Gerhardus Voss, about a century ago, warned against abstracting the love of God from his other attributes, noting that while God's love is revealed to be his fundamental attribute, it's defined by his other attributes as well. In other words, God's love and God's holiness, God's mercy and his justice are not different things. We only refer to those aspects of the divine perfection as different things because of our finitude and the necessity of putting finite words on them. God's character is not divided so that his love is at war with his justice, his mercy is at war with his righteousness. These things are all combined in perfection in him. And a part of God's perfect revelation to us is that hell is actually a part of God's perfect plan. Too many Christians hold to an unscriptural sentimentalism whereby God's love becomes a form of indulgence incompatible with God's hatred of sin. But we need to note that we're talking here not only about Christians, but about others around the world, for whom hell has become increasingly unthinkable. But what I find really interesting is to hear you have researchers asking if belief in hell makes you happy. That has to be one of the most absurd scientific questions I've ever heard. What difference does it make if a truth makes you happy or sad? It's the truth. This kind of research only makes sense among people who believe that theology is nothing but a mind game, and religion is nothing more than a social construct. And so you can take apart its doctrines and ask which one makes you happier, which one makes you holier, which one makes you more sensitive, which one makes you more empathetic, which one makes you more judgmental, when the real question is, what is true? And that is one of the most odd and offensive questions in our postmodern age. Shifting the focus to France, that nation is, by any measure, one of the most socially liberal on earth, and yet, evidently, at least some in France have some limitations. About 100,000 people recently protested in Paris against allowing same-sex couples to have access to advanced reproductive technologies. Over a million have marched in the streets of Paris to oppose the legalization of same-sex marriage, although the French government moved ahead with that provision. But what's going on in France now, as is reported by The Economist of London, is a controversy that reminds us of something of profound importance, and that is what our children read and what is read to them in children's books is determinative to a huge degree in what they believe and the kind of people they will eventually become. In other words, if you're going to argue about something important, children's books is something important to argue about. As The Economist reports, when culture wars break out in France, they usually have to do with protecting art house films or the French language. Political battles over family values are a lot rarer thanks to a fairly relaxed liberal consensus. Abortion in France, for example, is legal and free. Couples can enter into official unions without getting married. Gay marriage was legalized last year, and there is also a cross-party agreement in favor of a strict form of secularism and entrenched by law since 1905, which keeps religion out of public life. That's a very important statement. Keeps religion out of public life. Then comes this paragraph. Yet the country has recently found itself torn apart by virulent quarrels about the role and nature of the family. The most recent concerns several books designed for children of primary school age, bearing such titles as Jean Has Two Mummies, Daddy Wears a Dress, and Everybody Naked. A volume that shows, page by page, family members, a babysitter, a policeman, a teacher, and several others, all taking their clothes off. Now, some of you recall in the United States controversy over the book Heather Has Two Mommies, and similar books written for little boys, books that were written in the main to make one point, and that is, there is a pluralism and diversity of family forms, and one is just as good as any other. One of the other arguments used in terms of the publication of these books and the dissemination of these books in schools, the fact these books are in the collections of public libraries, one of the arguments for why these books should be published and disseminated, put in library collections, and read to children in the public schools, is that by reading these books, these families of diverse and plural forms will be normalized, and children will be desensitized, and they will no longer have the prejudice they might otherwise have against these families. Of course, that's the very purpose. But enough, cries Jean-François Copé, head of the main center-right party in France, as he leafed through this picture book in a television show. Such books as this, he declared, had no place as recommended reading materials in state schools. Now, he's been followed by many, many others, including thousands and thousands of parents who have said they don't want these books read to their children. They don't want their children getting the view of the family from books with titles such as Jean Has Two Mummies, and Daddy Wears a Dress, and Everybody Naked. By the way, the controversy here in the United States several years ago was over the book Heather Has Two Mommies. But the point that we have to make over and over again is that when you're talking about the normalization of sexual and romantic relationships and orientations, it never stops with just two mommies or two daddies. The next book in this series is Daddy Wears a Dress. Now just imagine your child in the public school between the ages of kindergarten and, say, the third or fourth grade, coming home with a book that says Daddy Wears a Dress or Everybody Naked, a book that is intended, I guess, graphically to desensitize children to any kind of nudity. Those who are behind this book, and it's part of a new government project, ABCD of Equality, is, quote, designed to counter gender stereotyping at a young age, end quote. In other words, the French government is behind this. And the French government has said it's our purpose to try to counter gender stereotyping at a young age. This has been tried in the United States, Germany, the Netherlands, Great Britain, and elsewhere. Efforts to try to tell boys and girls at very early ages that it doesn't make a difference, there shouldn't be any stereotyping, And yet, has even Christmas controversy revealed this year, when it comes to toys, boys go to the area where the boys' toys are, girls go to the area where the girls' toys are. In other words, I don't think these books are actually going to even accomplish the purpose for which their very liberal and progressive originators have intended. But that's not to say they will not change the worldview of the children who read them or who have them read to them. By the way, one other pattern to note in this is that oftentimes you'll have a government organization that lists a book like this as an alternative and then says, hey, we're not promoting it, we're just listing it. According to The Economist, the book in this case was not, in fact, a part of the official curriculum, but merely one of 92 suggested picture books on a website linked to by ABCD of Equality, from which primary teachers might choose to select their books. The Economist then says such details do not deter culture warriors. Well, that's because that detail may be a detail, but it's a big reality. In other words, if it's on the list of approved and recommended books, it is a part of the approved and recommended curriculum, regardless of how government bureaucrats might want to wash their hands of responsibility. Oh, and one other issue as relates to France and the situation revealed in this article. The French president, François Hollande, you'll know, is a liberal. He is a socialist, elected as head of a socialist government. And there are those in his party who believe that he hasn't gone far enough, and the government isn't going far enough even with this curriculum and even with these books. They don't want any retreat. They want advance. As The Economist writes, a new generation of socialist deputies has been drawn into politics not from the labor movement or local government, but from the nonprofit sector, where they fought for women's rights and against violence and discrimination. In a post-industrial era when workers have largely abandoned the left, the deputies see such issues as a key socialist battleground. They are furious about Mr. Hollande's retreat and in no mood to give up the struggle. End quote. Well, to put the issue bluntly, when a book collection including Jean Has Two Mummies, Daddy Wears a Dress, and Everybody Naked isn't going far enough, what in the world could be next? Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question in your voice. Just call 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.